Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It is Wednesday, the 29th of June. A very good morning to you and welcome to Africa Link. I'm Crispin Mwakideu in Bonn, Germany. Our main stories: South African public broadcaster SABC in crisis after several journalists are suspended for defying an editorial directive not to cover anti-government protests.
It's a capture of the state resulting in censorship, and it reverses our freedom. It's the same as the apartheid project. Can't be accepted.
Ethiopia has become a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council. What does this mean for the Horn of Africa nation?
It's a great significance for Ethiopia. In terms of peace and security, it's a great contribution for Ethiopia to enhance its role that she's playing for the last couple of years.
And behind the headlines, Uganda's parliament approves a cabinet made up of 81 ministers, the largest in the world, and the opposition is furious.
This cabinet has nothing to do with the provision of social services. It is just creating space for individuals, sometimes for personal, for welfare, and for political reasons.
These stories, plus we shall also meet a young Senegalese migrant who recently returned to Dakar after spending more than a decade in Spain. Stay tuned.
Top story.
Silence of the press. Three top journalists working for South Africa's public broadcaster SABC have turned to the Constitutional Court to appeal their suspension from SABC. The journalists were suspended after opposing a controversial editorial decision by Chief Operations Officer Claudi Motsoeneng, who ordered the public broadcaster not to cover the recent violent protests outside Pretoria. This comes as SABC on Tuesday announced James Aguma as the new acting CEO following the sudden resignation of Jimmy Matthews. From Johannesburg, Tuzo Kumalo brings us more details.
The SABC's actions have attracted comments from various sections of the South African society. Early this month, SABC Chief Operations Officer, COO, Claudi Motsoeneng, announced that the corporation is no longer going to broadcast protests and footage showing the destruction of property, claiming that showing such scenes would encourage other people to do the same. This comes at a time when violent protests by those dissatisfied with government decisions have been escalating across the country. Protesters have resorted to burning government and private property, blocking streets and looting shops. But many have accused the SABC of trampling on the people's access to information in order to cover the failures of the ruling ANC. Musi Maimane, leader of the Democratic Alliance Party, who recently led his party in a protest against the SABC at its headquarters in Johannesburg, has vowed to explore all possible avenues that will force SABC to behave like a public broadcaster.
You know, in 1994, the fight was for freedom and that we have a free press. And now what's happened here is state capture. It's a capture of the state resulting in censorship, and it reverses our freedom. It's the same as the apartheid project. Can't be accepted.
Ordinary South Africans have also lent their voices to the protest. Many of them, like young Adrina Mulaudzi, are calling for heads to roll at SABC, and they've made it clear that COO Claudi must be the first to leave.
He must go. First of all, I don't think he has the qualifications of the position that he has. And second of all, I think this is kind of like unfair. It's actually taking South Africa down. It's bringing the name down and embarrassing us.
Some SABC journalists and employees have also challenged their employer's decision. On Monday, SABC's acting group chief executive officer, Jimmy Matthews, resigned, citing what he termed as a corrosive work environment. This comes soon after three SABC journalists were suspended for questioning the ban on broadcasting protests. SABC journalist Lukanyo Talata, whose father was killed during the country's war for liberation, has publicly expressed his disappointment with his employer.
It's quite hard, and whatever's happening in the country in general is not the kind of country that my father and his colleagues would have laid down their lives for if they'd known, you know.
However, the public broadcaster has had some support from South Africans, including the ANC, which has supported the ban on televising protests. Zizi Godwa, ANC spokesperson, has taken a swipe at Matthews for publicly revealing his frustration with the public broadcaster.
He's talking about corrosive atmosphere. Is he party to that? Is he guilty of that corrosive behavior himself? What role did he play? Why must he announce it when he's outside?
SABC has recently cancelled a talk show called On the Record and another show called The Editors, where current affairs issues are robustly discussed. And there are now fears that there will be more bans and more cancellations to come.
DW correspondent Tuzo Kumalo in Johannesburg. To put the crisis unfolding at SABC into perspective, I turn to William Bird. He's the director of Media Monitoring Africa in Johannesburg, and I began by asking him to explain what was going on at SABC.
Well, what's going on is that there are people who are seeking to impose a vision from about the 1950s onto a democratic environment, which is to say that some people are seeking to reimpose censorship of a very brutal and archaic variety on the public broadcast. So the journalists at the SABC are being told, you're not allowed to cover this, you can cover that, you're not allowed to cover public protests, you're not allowed to do analysis of the president's spy tapes ruling, and if you disobey these things or if you show legitimate dissent, then we will suspend you. These are things that are not appropriate for a public broadcaster or indeed a broadcaster in any country which has media freedom enshrined in its constitution.
And where does this self-censorship in media in South Africa come from?
The SABC has a very checkered past. It was used for similar purposes to this under apartheid, and since then we've been working very hard as a nation to try and build it into a proper public broadcaster. I think what's happening now is that over the last few years, we've seen a gradual effort to capture the public broadcaster to ensure that it serves a minority view within the ruling party, which is to say to be scared of saying anything too critical and to make sure that they portray certain parties in a more positive light than others. So I think that it's sort of general tendencies are things where we're seeing the Minister of Communication, as an example, putting forward a bill that would see her gaining more control over the public broadcaster. We've seen the SABC adopting editorial policies which haven't followed due process. And now we're seeing decisions where a COO, so a chief operating officer, is engaging in critical editorial decisions, which the nature of which, he in this instance really shouldn't be engaged in.
How much influence does the ruling ANC have on South African media?
They're a majority party, the ANC in South Africa. They have just under, I think, around 63% of representation in Parliament. And I don't think anyone questions the legitimacy of that. So what we do know is that there's been a reasonably fractious, sometimes very fractious relationship with media. And sometimes that's warranted and sometimes it isn't. I think that the grave concern here is that this isn't just any media, this is a public broadcaster, and for them to be seeking to make the public broadcaster a state broadcaster again when we've just emerged from that brutal, oppressive past is something that is particularly distressing to any democracy-loving citizen.
The ANC has criticized Jimmy Matthews, the former SABC acting CEO, calling him a coward for resigning. Was that the right decision to resign?
I think that the issue is this, is what Jimmy Matthews' resignation symbolises and indicates is that there is a particularly grave crisis at the SABC. For the ruling party, for them to come out and make that kind of comment, it's simply and utterly astonishing. This is the party that introduced us to the Freedom Charter. This is the party that fought hard for an open media campaign in the worst days of apartheid. This is a party that helped ensure we have an independent public broadcaster. For them to now be aligning themselves with moves towards censorship and to be playing the man and not the issue indicates the severity of what is happening at the SABC, that some clearly within the ANC see fit to spew such fundamental nonsense.
Director of Media Monitoring Africa, William Bird, in Johannesburg.
Africa Link, every weekday on DW Deutsche Welle.
Departure, Egypt. Destination, Europe. The head of the EU border agency Frontex, Fabrice Leggeri, on Tuesday warned that migrants are now turning to Egypt as a departure point for the dangerous sea journey on the Mediterranean. In West Africa, however, Senegal in particular, sea crossings to the Spanish Canary Islands remain one of the favoured routes that migrants use to come to Europe. Our reporter Emanuele Lande met one Senegalese migrant who has just returned from Spain to Dakar and filed this report.
Mantani Diaye spent 11 years living in Spain as an illegal immigrant. While he was there, he sold cheap knockoff watches and bags on the beaches for a living. Now 46 years old, he returned back to Senegal 6 months ago through voluntary repatriation. He received a small grant to set up a grocery business in one of Dakar's markets, where he told me his story.
I left at the end of 2005 to go to Europe in order to find work and be able to feed my family. I knew nobody there and didn't know where I was going. I left by boat. I don't know where the boat left from. I didn't know Dakar. They just told me we were going to Spain.
As a young man living in Saint-Louis in northern Senegal, he thought travelling to Europe by boat was his only way to secure a better future. Diaye saved everything he could for 10 years until he had 800 euros that would buy him a sea crossing to Spain. It took him 7 days to reach Spain's Canary Islands with 95 others. Life in Europe was harder than anything he'd imagined. He lived in a cramped four-room flat with 7 other Senegalese. After deciding to return to Senegal, Diaye approached the repatriation operations jointly organised by the International Organisation for Migration and the Senegalese government, who flew him back.
It's the best decision I ever made. I'm never going back. I'm done. Every day over there, I was suffering. I regret going and leaving my wife for 11 years, and what I thought I would make working in Europe, I never made. I had no money. The work was hard.
Patrols have been put in place to stop boats leaving from the coast of Senegal, which means the migrants travel overland up the continent. The organisation puts the number of Senegalese who reached the Mediterranean coast in 2015 at 5,000. Jo Lind Robertson is the country director for the International Organisation of Migrations in Senegal.
There's a slight increase of Senegalese arrivals in Italy. So now the road has very much changed. 10 years ago, it was almost only by sea, and now it's very much Senegalese leaving from Senegal over to Niger, Burkina Faso, and going up towards Libya. The sea route is now unused.
So far this year, from January to May, more than 2,500 Senegalese made it to detention centres in Italy, but for thousands of others, the journey stops in Libya. A handful of migrants with a livestock, agriculture or trade project receive individual or community financial support from the IOM.
The migrants who benefit from these programmes, we're their last call of assistance. They've tried everything to get to Europe and it hasn't worked, and they have no money left to get home. They're in a dire situation.
Once back in Dakar, other migrants are given a sandwich and 150 euros in aid from the government, something that Boubacar Say, president of the organisation Horizon Sans Frontières, deplores.
Aujourd'hui, l'urgence.
Today, the emergency is creating training and job opportunities that must be set up, and some people are in a position to do it, but unfortunately, they are not included in the debate, because what we say does not go their way. All that suits them here is when they get a call from Europe to give them funds to fight illegal immigration. These funds do not benefit those entitled to be helped. And this is where we call on the International Committee to audit these funds, because if there is no monitoring, then it's absolutely useless.
Since the beginning of 2015, Senegal has repatriated more than 1,000 migrants.
Emanuele Lande in Dakar.
Behind the headlines.
For Behind the Headlines, we head to Uganda. The East African nation has beaten every other country when it comes to the number of ministers. 81 cabinet posts were approved by the Ugandan parliament following President Yoweri Museveni's re-election in February. But as Alex Jita reports from Kampala, many citizens and opposition parties are calling for a reduction in the number of ministers.
With 81 cabinet ministers, Uganda now has the biggest cabinet in the world. President Museveni was expected to reduce the number of ministers when he was sworn in last month, but shocked many when he instead created more ministries and hence appointing more ministers. Museveni has argued before that more ministers will translate into better service delivery. However, this has been challenged by analysts who spoke to DW. Leonard Okello of the Uhuru Governance Institute believes the president considered the social and ethnic setup of Uganda while naming his cabinet.
The cabinet is a reflection of the politics of the nation. The politics of the nation in Uganda is identity politics, which tribe feels represented or not on cabinet, which religion thinks they are represented or not, or which social groups are into, like people with disability. So you actually find it's not necessarily about performance, it's about identity politics first.
Already, some regions are complaining that their people were not appointed to the new cabinet. Uganda's Minister of Information Technology and Communications, Frank Tumwebaze, says that indeed, the president considers ethnic representation while appointing his ministers.
The constitutional framers were mindful of the geographical setup of Uganda and the marked and heterogeneous society we are in, which requires involving every ethnic group in the governance structure. So it's big but proportional to the population we have and to the societal arrangement we are in. What is important is, what are these ministers for? They are supervising the country. They are offering policy guidance.
The Ugandan constitution states that the president should have 21 ministers, but also allows him to add some if he deems necessary. Civil society organizations and the Ugandan political opposition alike have for some time been calling for a smaller cabinet. Kizza Besigye, Museveni's biggest political rival, had promised to reduce the number of ministers. The spokesperson of the Forum for Democratic Change, Ibrahim Samuju, says the president has only rewarded his political friends.
This cabinet has nothing to do with the provision of social services. It is just creating space for individuals, sometimes for personal, for welfare, and for political reasons. You first plan for the infrastructure, identify the work to do. All that you have done now is to continue raiding the same resource envelope, to buy vehicles of 500 million, get a police escort, a driver, and allowances. So what we have today now is a government of self-service.
On top of the many ministers, Museveni has 120 presidential advisors and maintains over 130 resident district commissioners. The Resident District Commissioners, or RDCs for short, are the official representatives of the president in each district, and their core duty is to monitor security and monitor government development programs. Daniel Ruheza, a Makerere University law professor, thinks that RDCs can be dropped and the local units do the work on their own.
The police is the institution that should be vested with all the powers to enforce security and so on. Supervision is being done at local government level. And this is a full ministry of local government that is established. So at the end of the day, much as you have the resident district commissioner, I think you are more or less repeating the work that other people are doing.
People also continue to complain about the number of members of parliament, which now stands at 375. In comparison, Kenya has a larger population, but only 21 ministers to Uganda's 81 and only 349 parliamentarians. As a result, the country spends a lot of money on salaries and other expenditures for the MPs. In the most recent budget, the government increased taxes on basic human requirements, including sugar and fuel, to get more money to finance its activities and public service salaries.
Alex Jita reporting in Kampala. You're listening to Africa Link from DW Studios in Bonn, Germany. Ethiopia will soon be sitting at the most powerful table in the world. The Horn of Africa nation was on Tuesday chosen to join the UN Security Council as a non-permanent member. Ethiopia was unanimously approved by the African Union to contest for the seat. So what does this mean for Ethiopia and the region in general? I put that question to Abebe Ayente, who works with Ethiopia's Foreign Relations Strategic Studies Institute in Addis Ababa. We apologize for the poor telephone line.
is a great significance for Ethiopia as an individual country and as a dominant country which is trying to consolidate regional issues in the name of the African Union and other regional organizations. So this is the one, in terms of peace and security, it's a great contribution for Ethiopia to enhance its role that she is playing for the last couple of years. And on the other hand, it's a great opportunity for Ethiopia to represent the entire region in general, the Africa continent. And the other thing is that Ethiopia is a rising nation. It increases its responsibility and the role in the international arena.
As a non-permanent member, how much power and influence will Ethiopia have?
In terms of peace and security, it's the number four peacekeeping contributor in the region, and that role in the region is very high and significant in bringing peace and stability in the region as well. There are peacekeepings in neighboring countries, for example, in Sudan and Somalia. What makes difference for Ethiopia's role in the region in terms of security is that Ethiopia has three peacekeeping missions in Sudan as well as in South Sudan. So in general, there are three peacekeeping missions within one country, the oldest Sudan, but now the south and the north have separated since 1915 and now 1911. So it's a big role, and it will increase the responsibility that she's carrying out.
But just a few weeks ago, Ethiopia was involved in border skirmishes with Eritrea.
It will not affect the Ethiopia's role in the peace and security. Another way, I'll see it the other way around, because Ethiopia, being the non-membership in the Peace and the Security Council, will give the room to figure out the problems that sustained for the last 15 years between the two neighboring countries. I would say Ethiopia and Eritrea is two countries, but the nations and the citizens living in two countries, because they speak, they share the many of things, like, for example, the language, the culture, the social issues are common for both countries. So it will not affect definitely, but another way, it will contribute a lot to figure out the problems and bring peace and stability and to bring issue on table in the international system and resolve the sustaining conflict. No war, no peace situation between the two nations.
Abebe Ayente from Ethiopia's Foreign Relations Strategic Studies Institute.
Opinion.
For this week's opinion, we shall go back to our top story, which is about media censorship in South Africa. Three journalists have been suspended from the public broadcaster for opposing a directive not to cover anti-government protests. And the question we ask is this: how free is the media in your country? And what do you think of Uganda's new cabinet, which has 81 ministers? Send us your opinion on one or both of these stories via text message to country code 49160957 59510, an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or by mail to AfricaLink DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. And we will air some of your thoughts on Friday. And now, a reminder of our main stories. South Africa's public broadcaster SABC is facing a backlash after suspending three journalists who defied a ban of anti-government protests. Critics in Uganda have called on President Museveni to trim the number of cabinet posts, which now stands at 81. And Ethiopia has said it will work for the benefit of the African countries as a new permanent member, as a new non-permanent member of the UN Security Council. Well, that's all we had for you. Thank you for listening. Do join me at the same time tomorrow. Until then, I'm Crispin Mokideu. Have a wonderful day.